No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the discussion at 888-627-6008. Hello, Maria. How are things on the West Coast?
Hello, Senator. Well, we continue to have our heat wave, and being a resident of Los Angeles, we started the mask mandate indoors last night at midnight.
Wow.
So
wow, it's just crazy. And California is not a state that's under-vaccinated, though, are they?
Well, Los Angeles County has only 52% that are double vaccinated and 60% that have gotten at least one. So that's pretty low. I was mentioning today that if you don't want to get vaccinated, could you at least do it for those who are under 12 years of age? Because they can't do it. And yeah. I feel like if I had children that were under 12, I wouldn't let them go anywhere. I'd say you can play in the backyard or we can go to a park. I wouldn't put them at risk or exposure. It's too scary. And yeah. This Delta variant is so virulent and dangerous that it's even worse than it's ever been. And what I don't understand is, okay, I get it that you don't want to do it, but what about those that can't do it, like our children?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. And yeah, it's just... People have to do it for each other. And I don't get the whole thing where we can make you wear seatbelts. We can make you do all sorts of things.
For motorcycle helmets.
Right. For the protection of other people. But we can't do this. It's crazy.
It is.
Well, we have a special guest tonight, Professor Karen Cox. Dr. Cox is an award-winning historian and a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians. I'm sure that would be near and dear to Mrs. Brown's heart.
Absolutely.
She's written op-eds for the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, Time, the Huffington Post, and she's here to talk about her most recent book, No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. And this has been an issue that's been going on now for a couple of years. And we're glad that you're with us tonight, Dr. Cox, to talk about this, because I think it's important. And it's at the center of the news in the last couple of days. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you. This is my co-host, Maria Sanchez.
Hi.
And doctor, let's start right at the beginning. They took down the statue of Robert E. Lee this week in Charlottesville. We all remember that there was a violent confrontation that led to the death of Heather Heyer a few years ago, and there's been a years-long battle in the courtroom and outside the courtroom as well to take down the statue. First, let's talk about this. How do you feel? Was this the right thing to do, take this statue down?
Well, I mean, it is if that's the will of the community. I try not to get involved in the decision-making stuff of this. But yes, I mean, I believe that given the monument's ability to attract white supremacists, white nationalists, the death of Heather Heyer, it is probably the best move for the community.
So, and is that the criteria on whether these statues should stand or not, what the community thinks? I mean, isn't there a problem with us being somewhat historically pomorphic about all this stuff that we're judging some of these people by 2021 standards? And is that as a historian, do you think that's an appropriate thing for us to do?
Well, let's just put it this way. You've asked me a couple of things here. One is okay. About the local, you know, whether it's about local decision making. And the reality is the vast majority of Confederate monuments that exist were placed by a local community in their community. And so that's where the decision making often has to take place. Unless, of course, you know, laws have been passed, as they have been in several states, that prohibit local control over the issue. The other question you ask about whether we should apply this. I mean, look, we are not allowed to keep up Jim Crow signs. Those are historical, but we're not, you know, whites only, colored drinking fountains. We don't do that anymore. And, nor should we. And so I don't think anyone would say, oh, that would be okay to do that again because it's historical.
Well, is that what should happen to statues? Should they go to the same place that whites-only drinking signs go, which is a museum? I mean, here at the African-American Museum here in Washington, we certainly have those signs.
Correct. But the thing is, it's like in a community, let's say, you know, depending on where they are, these things are enormous in size. They don't always nicely fit into a local museum or even on the grounds of a museum. The other thing is that what we're asking of museums is to take on the problem. And this may not be, part of their collections policy to take in these sorts of things. And then basically you're punting the ball. You're just like kicking it down the street. And so now it becomes a problem of a museum. Even if they can provide the proper context for it, the thing about these statues is that they're enormous, which is, if you think about early on, you know, people talked about providing context, you know, like historical context around these monuments. But think about the optics problem. A 4x6 foot panel with some historical data on it standing next to a 30-foot monument is the problem. It's an optics problem, and the dominant narrative, which is that of Confederate memory and the lost cause, that dominant narrative still looks dominant even with the context that's provided on a small panel. So it's not as simple as just giving it to a museum.
Well, I noticed that in the paper today, somebody wrote, and I was surprised to see this, in response to the Charlottesville removal of the Robert E. Lee statue, that Robert E. Lee himself was against these things, against these statues. She wrote that he was invited to Gettysburg at one point where they were going to put up statues, and he said, I think it is wiser, moreover, not to keep open the sores of war, but to follow the examples of those nations who've endeavored to obliterate the marks of civil strife, to commit to oblivion the feelings they engendered. So it looks like Robert E. Lee might have been in favor of taking the statue down. He also said that although he would be grateful that the South would think enough to put a statue up for him, it would have the effect of continuing, if not adding, to the difficulty under which the Southern people labor. Lee and Jefferson Davis thought the Confederate flag, as well the stars and bars, should be put away and never used again. So they themselves, it seems, were not much in favor of monuments. So the monuments really take on a different meaning, don't they? It's really not so much about the person they're erected to as the people that actually erect them. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, it is a reflection of the people who placed them there. And it is true that Lee, you know, said those things in the, you know, but he died 5 years after the Civil War ended. And so that movement to erect monuments was really larger than he was. And as far as Davis is concerned, he was unreconstructed the rest of his life. He still believed in the cause of the South and the Confederacy. Right. And he actually attended monument unveilings. So,
Oh, he did.
Yeah,
well, there you
he
go.
Did. And so,
yeah. How about that? A politician that speaks out of both sides of his mouth. I can't imagine that. Maria, do you have a question? I don't want to hog all of Dr.
I do. So, Dr. Cox, welcome to the program, and thank you for making the time. And
sure.
The title of your book is No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. Is it correct to say that No Common Ground is because this is so polarizing? And have we seen other things like this in our history, such as slavery and whether or not to give reparations, or the women's rights movement, or giving black men the right to vote and women the right to vote? Were those also causes that had no common ground, or do you see this as distinctly unique in that?
The reason I titled the book No Common Ground is twofold. One is that there is no common ground over what people believe that these monuments mean. That, you know, depending on your point of view, they either honor heroes or they honor people who fought to perpetuate human slavery. So that's the no common ground. The other part of it is that what should be common ground, which is the courthouse grounds where the vast majority of these monuments exist, should be common ground, should be democratic spaces, but are not because of the existence of those monuments. And so that's where the no common ground comes from. I'm not going to equate the monument issue with all the number of issues that you raised there. They're all, in some ways, some of these things are tied together. Voter suppression is tied into these monuments. You know, and the reason and the way that is that basically you can't, because of gerrymandering, you can't elect officials who represent your point of view about monuments, and which is why we have laws that are in place that aren't likely to go away as long as you can't elect officials who will amend those laws. The reason that you could take a monument down in Charlottesville, Virginia, is because the state legislature of Virginia switched over, you know, and is now Democratic controlled. So, yes. I mean, there's always been issues that divide us all along the way, but how people perceive it is, I think there's some wiggle room on some of these other issues that you pointed out, but on monuments, it's just. Really, absolutely divided. There is no common ground over that, over this issue. There's no in between.
And as a follow up to that, because I don't think that I had ever heard of it called the Lost Cause, could you share what that is with our listeners and how it contributed to whites basically understanding what happened in the Civil War and slavery and the Confederate leaders?
Yeah. So the Lost Cause is the term that white Southerners themselves used to in reference to the Confederate cause, during the Civil War, that the cause for at least for them and understanding it was a lost cause, that it remained a just cause. They believed that. They would even say it was a sacred cause. And so the Lost Cause is a narrative that emerges immediately after the Civil War to basically justify defeat. Like, how did we, you know, we were, they believed so wholeheartedly in their cause and that they thought they were going to go into the war and the war would be over and they would have whipped the Yankees and then that everybody would go home. And that's not the way, obviously, that it turned out. So a narrative emerges to help these white Southerners deal with their defeat and the loss. And so one of the main myths of the Lost Cause is that the Civil War had never been fought over slavery. It was over states' rights. And so that particular narrative is carries on generation after generation. It gets, you know, embellished and other things are added into it, you know, ideas that slavery wasn't a bad, you know, was not a bad institution. There were faithful slaves. Reconstruction was a bad thing. It, you know, all Confederate soldiers are heroes. You know, it just goes on and on. There's a lot of the myths that form part of this narrative, but all of it was a way to continue to believe in the justification of secession and the cause. And so that narrative and monuments are part of that. So are you know, pro-Southern textbooks that get in the school system in the white public schools of the South. There's, you know, and so it gets perpetuated generation after generation till, you know, even in 2021, you hear, you know, regional politicians say, well, the Civil War was never about slavery. It was about states' rights.
Yeah,
and
we hear that all the
time. That's a myth of the Lost Cause. Yeah.
We hear that all the time with the Stars and Bars. You know, when people are flying the Stars and Bars, they're saying, well, it's not about, you know, that's not the, it's not about the Confederate battle flag. It's not about slavery. It's about tradition. It's about our, you know, our tradition in the South. But let me ask you, is there some danger in being, I mean, I don't even know how to ask this question, being too truthful? When we look at the causes of the Second World War, for example, a lot of people say that a lot of historians have said one of the primary causes of the Second World War was the fact that after the First World War, the Germans were beaten so much into submission that there was the German hyperinflation, that they were forced to pay reparations, that they were really driven, you know, that all the allies got together and did whatever they could to keep them down and hold them down. So is there a, and that's what caused them to, right, to reorganize and come back with a fury. Is there some danger? Should we give a little to history?
No, we don't give one, nothing. We don't give anything on history. That's not the way history works. We don't accept. We have to we have to maintain and defend facts over these false narratives, because it's the false narratives that got us into trouble, you know, over and over again. I mean, the false narrative of the Lost Cause is something that, you know, reemerges during Jim Crow and leads to the legalization of segregation. It reemerges during as part of the massive resistance to civil rights at mid-century. It reemerged in the 1990s when you began to see the beginnings of gerrymandering. It reemerged again in 2015 with the massacre of 9 people in Charleston. We do not, absolutely do not, give on the facts of history. We do not give in and allow that to be misinterpreted.
So let me ask you, we have a very tough situation here in Washington, D.C. First of all, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there was a time in Washington, D.C. where if you wanted to put up a monument, all you had to do was pay for it. There are some incredible monuments in the District of Columbia. There's a monument to the guy that invented the bobbin, for example, because the International Lady Garment Workers Union put up the money to build a monument to this person. So there's all sorts of crazy monuments here, but one that we have a particular problem is a statue of Abraham Lincoln that sits in one of our parks or our local parks with a slave that kneels at Lincoln's.
Yes, I'm familiar.
And you know, the monument was built by, it was paid for by slaves, and it was designed by an African-American, and it was paid for by slaves, but many African-Americans are offended by it. They're offended at this, you know, at the, well, like you say, you're familiar. They're offended that the slave is at the knee of Abraham Lincoln. And there's a lot of African-Americans that are calling to tear that statue down. What do you think of that? That you know, African, that black people built it, black people designed it, but now there are black people that want to take it down.
Well, it's part of, I'm not going to get into should we or not. It's part of the evolution of communities, you know, of what represents your community. What represented your community maybe in the 19th century doesn't represent your community in the 21st century. And so, you know, if that is the, you know, like, again, if it's the will of the people to make those changes, I mean, it's no different than me saying, well, white people put up these Confederate monuments and now white people want to take it down. You know,
well, that's true.
Because, right? I mean, and so it's about our evolution as a society and as communities and whether or not we feel like that represents us. And, you know, the thing is like one of the things that people I don't think understand and about monuments, and I found this to be true with Confederate monuments, is people just make this assumption that it was only, you know, within the last 5 years that people even criticized Confederate monuments or any other type of monument. The fact of the matter and what I discovered in doing my research for the book is they've been complaining about Confederate monuments since they started building them in the 19th century. No one was listening. No one was listening. And it could be that, you know, there have been, you know, sometimes that community members are, you know, like around the Lincoln with the kneeling slave, you know, may have decided that, you know, now they would like to see it done, but there could, you know, there's probably, and we don't know it because people weren't paying attention all the time to those communities. And they may have been saying in their homes, in their churches, in their Masonic halls that they don't like the image of the kneeling slave. And it's only been in the last few years that they've been able to come out and really speak about those things. And that's really it's true around Confederate monuments. You know, if you had, if black members of the black community had protested a Confederate monument during Jim Crow, they could have been lynched.
Right.
So, you know, you have to, we've evolved as a society, and that means our ideas about what these monuments mean and represent has also evolved.
Well, and being here in California, we have something similar with Father Junipero Serra, who founded our missions. And there, I live in a community that took one of the statues down because he was in front of City Hall because of what they allege he did to the Native people, and particularly in this area, the Chumash people. And they literally just removed it and put it away, and it's nowhere to be seen.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the problems, though, is, you know, that I have. Now, I don't have a problem. I'm a politician, so I don't have a problem taking a political stand on any of this. And I think you're absolutely right about the D.C. statue as far as people's attitudes changing. I think if the people want it to come down, it should come down. I don't think we should, you know, it doesn't matter who built it. Doesn't matter who paid for it. If it offends people in this time, in this day and age, I think it should come down. But how do we decide what monuments stay and what monuments come down. I mean, George Washington was a slave owner. Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner. If there are people that argue that their monuments should come down, should we listen to them? Or is there, there's no objective criteria that we can put in place to make these decisions?
Well, it's not fair to equate George Washington and Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee committed treason. He took up arms against the United States, and he fought in a war to perpetuate human slavery. Yes, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, as the other one is often mentioned, were slave owners, but they also helped found our country. So I think that, you know, the ways in which historians see them are very different, and they think about, you know, one of the things that we can do is to talk honestly about the founding fathers, about the fact that they were slave owners. And I think they're doing that at Monticello. They're doing that at Mount Vernon. And I don't think that that's going to affect, you know, for example, monuments in Washington. They weren't erected to, those monuments weren't erected to him because he owned slaves. They were erected to him because he was a father of the country, right? Whereas the monuments to someone like Robert E. Lee, they are, you know, they're erected to a man who actually did, you know, who fought in a war to perpetuate slavery. Those are very, very different kinds of reasons for putting up the monument. And the thing is, you're right. There are, like, I lived in D.C. for about 5 years, and so I'm familiar with the numbers and the monuments and the various kinds of monuments around there. And so what do you do? It's like, maybe one of the things, you know, we can do in the way we think about the memorial landscape of any community is this, like, you know, put some criteria into place before you put up any monument, right, before going forward. And then to think about and reconsider what's in your community. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. We didn't have a whole grouping of Confederate monuments in the city, but we did have a few. And then we also have a lot of street names that are named for, Confederate generals, but also white supremacists. And so those things are going to be changed because the community is asking for that. And so again, that's why it gets back to what I said earlier, that each community has to make decisions around that and establish criteria. And there have been communities working on that kind of thing. You know, Louisville, Kentucky developed a set of criteria, for example, about what, you know, about, you know, before any new monument goes up, maybe that it'd have to meet a certain criteria.
Well, and with all due respect, Senator, you in 2018 have the Marion Barry statue.
Yeah, you do. Well, and there's plenty of people. Look, there's plenty of people in Washington, D.C. that think Marion Barry was just a great guy. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, that's why they erected the statue to him. And there's also the other statue that's just in front of City Hall. On the other side of City Hall for the district building, which was there before the D.C. government moved in there, was Boss Shepherd. And Boss Shepherd was a, you know, kind of a Boss Tweed kind of character, but he was in D.C. He did some interesting public project. He built sewers, for example, for the first time in D.C. But he was also about as corrupt as a politician could possibly be. But yeah, those are our two statues in front of them. And let me ask you, Dr. Cox, something more, how about something more contemporary? Like, what about Howard University? They're changing the names of schools. We just had, I think it was Jefferson and Lee, or something in Lee School in Virginia was changed, Northern Virginia. But You've also got Howard University. Howard University is named for the man that founded it, who started a college for the children of slaves. But he was also a guy that massacred untold numbers of Native Americans, including women and children. If that doesn't offend people, we just leave it alone? Or if it, you know, still I see a hard thing without having some sort of criteria.
It has to be, and it has to be developed. Again, the university itself is a community, right? And right. So they have to, like, to make those calls and on how they wish to address it. The same with, you know, Washington and Lee in Virginia. So I get it and I understand it, but they, you know, those are individual communities with a, you know, alumni, and, you know, those things are hot potatoes. I wouldn't want to weigh in on it. I mean, because I think it is something that they're having to grapple with. I mean, the University of South Carolina, a group of historians did all sorts of research and came up with reasons why there should be some name changes on the campus there, because they have buildings named for white supremacists and segregationists, et cetera, including Strom Thurmond. But the state law is going to prevent that from happening, because because they get state funding, they fall under the law in South Carolina that requires a 2/3 majority to even change the law or even change a name on a building. And so sometimes there, you know, places are prevented from doing the kinds of work that communities have been trying to do around this issue.
Well, you know, we had, you talk about state law. We had someone on our show a few weeks ago whose uncle was Rosa Parks' lawyer, and they want to name the street that his little law office is on. They want to rename it after him. But there's a law in Alabama that this is in Montgomery. There's a law that says if the street's named after a Confederate general, you can't change the name of the street. And it is. It's named after, I forget what the current name of the street is, but they can't get it changed because of a law in Alabama. So there are there's so many of these strange laws out there. Well, what can we do moving forward, Dr. Cox? What do you think communities can do? This is particularly an important issue in Washington, D.C., of course, because we have so many monuments and we're so proud of our beautiful city. You've lived here and part of the whole thing is the monuments, right? And so what do we do to move forward? Should every community develop a group of people that can review the monuments that exist, as well as criteria for putting up new monuments?
Well, I mean, whenever there are some changes that are taking place, it's been done by grassroots activists. And so they have to put enough pressure on their local community to develop a set of criteria. And that doesn't happen everywhere. You know, in small communities in Alabama, that's not happening. In a place like Louisiana, you could move monuments in New Orleans, there have been no monuments removed outside of the city of New Orleans in the state of Louisiana. I mean, so in places where, you know, I think the thing is that you begin, the community activists are part of the solution on this. I think that there are groups out there, that are at least develop documents, you know, like, that document the history of these monuments so that we know, who this person that was honored, what kind of person that they were, and, you know, and what it represents. But this is, in some ways it's not about about monuments. It's about, you know, what people, and this is part of the culture war. Okay. You know, it's like, it's the monument is sort of represents that the bigger issues that we're actually having, debates over, which is systemic racism and you know, police brutality and all the other things. Like that's, you know, we're having that conversation around, but you know, around monuments. But monuments just are just symbolic of all these things that that we really need to be addressing. Yeah, we can remove the monuments, but we're still going to have systemic racism. We're still going to have white supremacy. We're still going to have police brutality unless those things get addressed.
Well, that's absolutely true. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Maria.
What I appreciate, Dr. Cox, about your approach is that you are obviously passionate, it's palpable, about history and not changing it or revising it or filtering it. And I appreciate that a lot because as a professor of history and the founding director of the Graduate Public History Program, I can see that you find that there's integrity, whether it was good, bad, or ugly, or blemished, or filled with warts, or what have you. It is our history, and what is the adage about those that forget the history will repeat the mistakes again? But on that note about what you were talking about, racism and police brutality and all of that stuff, what is your thinking about critical race theory? Where does that fit historically?
It's a red herring. It's a political red herring. That's what it is. Like, you know, I don't teach critical race theory. I teach history. If I teach American history and I teach Southern history, I would, you know, be remiss and it would be irresponsible of me to not talk about race and slavery and segregation and Jim Crow and all those things that shaped the region that I live in and where my students live. You know, so, you know, it's not, and people aren't teaching this in school. This is just a red herring. It's it's like throwing red meat out there for people to get their back up about this issue. And that's not happening. It is not happening in the schools. It's not happening in my classroom. And, you know, but they have grabbed a hold of this narrative and are running with it. And, I don't know what to do about that, you know, because it's not
there.
A true thing. Yeah.
I got to agree with you there, Dr. Cox. I heard a congressman stand up the other day and say teaching critical race theory makes it look like the people that founded our country were racist. And I thought about it for a second. And I said to myself, is there really any other way to think of people that own slaves as anything but racist? I mean,
they definitely believed in white supremacy and the superiority of their race. Or they wouldn't have done that to begin with.
Right, of course. And you know, it just seems to me once you've checked the box, yes, I am a slave owner, then you're a racist.
I think the thing here is that that's not all of who they are.
It is
very much a part of who they are. Mm-hmm. So you either give, you know, the complicated full accounting of a person's life, or you start to, you know, cherry pick. And if you only want to see, you know, founding fathers in a positive light, then you are whitewashing history.
Right. And that's certainly, you know, we see that in politics all the time. For example, the latest example, of course, is Donald Trump. But, you know, my colleague Maria brought up Marion Barry earlier. There are people that love Marion Barry, so they don't see that he did anything wrong. They can't, you know, just like with Donald Trump, there are people, what do we call them? You know, I forget the term we use for him, Trumpers or whatever. And no matter what he does, if it's something that's untoward, then it's false. It's false news. You know, nothing.
Right.
They only see what they want to see. You know, and that's very true in politics. If they like you, they like you. And if they don't like you, yeah, you can't do anything right. So yeah, that's very much a part of the whole thing.
But as a historian, I think we need to just understand that we're human beings, and we're complex characters. We're neither you know all good nor all bad, you know. And people will assign certain some of their values with someone like Trump, and they feel like he best represents them, while other people feel like he's, the worst thing to ever happen, So it just, but the thing is, it's like, people aren't one or the other. They're, if you think about them as human beings in their full complexity, there's going to be good and bad. And as a historian, I want to know all of that. I don't want to know just the good
one
bit.
Version.
I want to.
Well, isn't Jefferson the best example of that? Like, all the great things that he did for our country, and then that concubine of his, too, and, and then the slaves. And I mean, I think your point is well taken. Humans are flawed to begin with.
Yeah,
some more than others. Some great minds... Okay. I mean, how many times do we hear stories about somebody who did this magnificent thing that turned out that they were a pedophile, or that, they were an adulterer? I mean, it's like, really? All of that went on, and yet we still thought you were this paragon of virtue because you taught us this, or you founded that, or you had us think in a different way, opening up our paradigm. But I just want you to know, Dr. Cox, I just love how you love history.
I love it. I really do love it. But I love it so much. It's like, I want to know all of it. I think history would be so boring if all we learned was just like this one point of view, only the good stuff. That it's like it's what makes history fascinating, is that people are so complex that there's no easy answer to understanding that our history is a nation. And why wouldn't we want to know all of it? I don't know. I want, to know and learn as much as I can. And it's not making a judgment. It's about making, having an understanding.
Well, and knowing the truth. And to what, Michael, you were talking about earlier, is that what's known as confirmation bias, people seek out that which they already know to be true for them. Sure. And to me... When I know what Fox is going to say, but I don't necessarily know what CNN and NBC are going to say. So why would I go to the source where I already know the note that they're going to hit, instead of to other sources that might bring up different things that I might not have considered?
Let me ask you, Doctor, this is something that I really don't understand. I have a master's degree in public policy, so I've got a pretty decent education, but there were major things in history that I was never taught. One of the things that amazed me when I read about the Amistad, for example, I thought to myself, when the first time I read about that 10 years ago or so, or maybe it was even longer ago than that, when the movie came out, and I said to myself, why didn't I know this? Why didn't I know that there was this slave... this amazing story where a former president acted as the counsel for this group of slaves who were really freemen before the Supreme Court in this amazing case. And there's so many things like that in history. Why weren't we taught things like that? Is it because white people wrote the history books?
Well, I think, we've had that. Certainly that's been the case for many decades, and the ways that people have learned, the history of the South, in their public schools, it was all about their heroes, Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and the like. And, they weren't learning the stories of slavery, or they weren't even learning the stories of, people who were very well accomplished. Because, history is, knowledge is power. And if you don't want people to have the knowledge about certain things, you maintain power for yourself. And so, But, you know, it's not as though historians like myself haven't been writing these books. And even before me, somebody, you know, there were African-American historians who have been contributing to our knowledge of slavery and Jim Crow and the law and so on and so forth. You know, we have generated that knowledge. Whether or not it makes it into school textbooks is another story. And textbooks are notoriously political things. You know, it's like, you know, we know this, that we, like, you know, we don't, because, say, a school system like Texas, you know, public schools there, they don't want you to talk about slavery.
Right.
You know, in the school system. They're already, I just saw something run across my feed and on Twitter where the Texas has passed the bill. They don't even want you to learn about the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, in other words, they've removed it as a requirement. It used to be, you know, so it's not that you can't teach it, but it's no longer a requirement. So they're trying to, they're already, you know, they attacking these things because it's, you know, knowledge is power, and mm-hmm. historical knowledge is power.
Well, let me ask you, this is probably the most controversial thing I'm going to ask you. Another thing that
I'll see if
troubles
I can
me. All right, so sit down. But, you know,
okay.
This is the absolute first thing they do at the end of a communist revolution, doctor. The first thing the communists do is they tear down all the statues. They rewrite all the history. Is there any danger for us in doing this?
In doing what? Tearing down Confederate monuments?
Tearing down the statue. Yeah. I mean, isn't it right? I remember my sister was one of the first people to go to China after Nixon opened it up. And she said the thing that she found most astounding was that there were all these educated people that she dealt with that had no sense of Chinese history prior to the revolution. That they only taught, they tore down all the statues, they changed all the history books. They only taught history to students from the revolution, you know, from Mao Zedong on,
mm-hmm.
Nothing before that. So is there any danger in us tearing, you know, changing the history books to the point where we forget some of this history?
No, I don't think we'll forget the history. The thing is to remember is that monuments are not history. Monuments do not teach history lessons. Monuments are a reflection of a generation of people who placed them there. And if in the case of Confederate monuments, the vast majority were placed during the era of Jim Crow. So these are mm-hmm. Jim Crow monuments. These aren't monuments about Confederate history. They're monuments that reflect the Jim Crow generation's efforts to continue to honor the Confederacy in the 20th century and to send out a message to African Americans that they're second class citizens.
Right.
And indeed, that's what they were doing. I mean, in some ways, the South narrative of the Civil War, you know, there's a saying among historians that the North won the war and the South won the peace. And the way the South won the peace was through this narrative, false narrative about what the war was about, et cetera, such that it has influenced generation after generation who don't really know it unless they step into a university classroom or they have, you know, or a teacher that teaches them these things. And what I'm seeing right now is this effort to not even let you learn that history anymore. To, you know, to refocus on the founding fathers, you know, and whitewash history so that the people, it helps them maintain power.
Mm.
If everybody believes that, yeah, you know, and if you can't learn, you know, about the full complexity of the nation's history, it's a power move. It's definitely a power move. And to throw out the red herring of CRT and that kind of thing, it just whips people into a frenzy, and when it's not even happening, and what we're getting to the point where they're saying, well, you know, where there's almost really what they're saying is that we don't want you to teach about race in this country. We don't want you to teach about slavery. We don't want you to talk about Jim Crow or civil rights, even though that is so central to the history of the United States.
Well, you know, I will say I have family in Alabama, and I've done a lot of traveling in the South, and I've seen lots of statues of Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis, but I can't remember ever seeing a statue of Abraham Lincoln south of the Mason-Dixon line. So, it's obvious that, yeah, they do, that does support their narrative. And, it's a real conundrum that we're going to have to face. Well, let me tell you, we're running out of time here, Doctor. So first, let me ask you, how can people get your book? Do you want to,
The book is No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice, and it can be found on all the online retailers, as well as University of North Carolina Press website, which is who I published the book with. But also, I always encourage people to go to their local bookstores.
And nice. Do you have a website that people can plug into if they want more information? Do you want to give a...
Yeah, sure. My website is KarenCoxHistorian.com. Altogether, Karen Cox. Yeah, that's KarenCoxHistorian.com. If you Googled my name, you wouldn't have a hard time finding me.
I'm curious, what attracted you to history? You got your BA, your MA, and your PhD. What got you there?
Well, you know, I think I did have, it was the one class I always enjoyed, and I had a good junior high teacher. Then, you know, I had the unfortunate experience that many people have, is that the football coach taught the history class in high school. And then I went to college, and it was really funny because I remember starting, and they said, well, you need to declare a major. And I said, and I just sit and talk to myself, well, what classes do I like the most? And it's history. And I just love it. I've never lost interest. There's always something new to think about and write about. And I will not live long enough to write all the books that I want to write.
Mm.
Wow.
What a great answer. Thank you.
Yeah, and we appreciate you. Now, do you teach it at North Carolina?
I teach at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte.
Charlotte.
So that's where I am, at that branch of the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. So, yes, I do teach, and we're gearing up for in-person instruction.
In-person.
So, yep. Cool. So that's happening, and I'll be, yeah. So, it's going to be weird after a year and a half of not being in the classroom. My hope is that after, a few weeks, I'll just find the groove again and it'll be okay.
I'm sure you will.
Yeah. And thanks so much for being on our show. We so much appreciate it. And we wish you success in the future. Your students are lucky to have a professor that loves so much what she does. So, and it's hard for me to say nice things about somebody that works at the University of North Carolina, because I went to the University of Maryland, and you guys used to beat us at basketball all the time.
I didn't go to school, and I do not teach at the University of North Carolina. That's in Chapel Hill.
We already researched that, Doctor, and we found that out. But thank you so much.
Well, I enjoyed talking with you.
And continued success.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we have at the end of the show, every week we play a song. This goes out to Dr. Cox for being so generous and being with us today. Here's a classic from the Kingston Trio. Where have all the flowers gone? Oh. Where have all the monuments gone? Okay, see you next week.
Yes, thank you, listeners.